GCC countries want Pakistan to give recognition to Israel.
Political analysts say that Pakistan is running out of options, and in the current situation, it may inch closer to Turkey, Qatar, Iran, and more particularly to China, to offset pressure from Saudi Arabia and UAE, which are strengthening their alliance with Israel, US, and India. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
In the limelight.
The UK is to host vital UN climate talks called COP26 in Glasgow next November, postponed by a year by the pandemic, at which all nations will be expected to come forward with national plans on emissions. Known as Nationally Determined Contributions, or NDCs, these plans for carbon curbs by 2030 are the bedrock of the 2015 Paris Agreement. As host, the UK will be expected to show purported leadership on its NDC in the hope of pushing other countries towards the tougher targets needed. Under current NDCs submitted in 2015, greenhouse gas emissions globally would reach levels giving rise to 3 degrees centigrade of heating, far in excess of the Paris upper limit of 2 degrees Celsius, and likely to cause devastating extreme weather. Lord Stern of Brentford, who is an advisor to the government on COP26, said recently that the UK government should submit a 70% emissions cutting target for its NDC. However, the government's target is likely to fall slightly below that figure at 68% to 69%, though it will still represent a hastening of effort. Current plans under the UK's carbon budgets would imply a cut of about 61% by 2030. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Fiona Harvey, an environment correspondent, under the heading UK's 2030 carbon target set to disappoint green campaigners. This article has been appeared on the front page of TheGuardian.com. Please stay tuned for more. Green campaigners and climate experts are set for disappointment as the UK government prepares to publish its carbon target for 2030. Environmental and development groups have been pushing the Prime Minister to opt for a stretching target of cutting emissions by 75% by 2030 compared with 1990 levels, which would have put the UK at the forefront of developed countries in fighting the climate crisis. The UK is to host vital UN climate talks called COP26 in Glasgow next November, postponed by a year by the pandemic, at which all nations will be expected to come forward with national plans on emissions. Known as Nationally Determined Contributions, or NDCs, these plans for carbon curbs by 2030 are the bedrock of the 2015 Paris Agreement. As host, the UK will be expected to show purported leadership on its NDC in the hope of pushing other countries towards the tougher targets needed. Under current NDCs submitted in 2015, greenhouse gas emissions globally would reach levels giving rise to 3 degrees centigrade of heating, far in excess of the Paris upper limit of 2 degrees centigrade, and likely to cause devastating extreme weather. Lord Stern of Brentford, who is an advisor to the government on COP26, told The Guardian recently that the UK government should submit a 70% emissions cutting target for its NDC. Stern said, "The Prime Minister now understands that this is a growth story, not a burden," adding, "but it does need strong investment and innovation." However, the government's target is likely to fall slightly below that figure, at 68% to 69%, though it will still represent a hastening of effort. Current plans under the UK's carbon budgets would imply a cut of about 61% by 2030. The increased effort is not likely to cost the UK more. The Committee on Climate Change, the government's statutory advisor, will report in coming days that the costs of reducing emissions have plunged in recent years. Green campaigners argue that the rapidly falling costs mean the government should go further and faster. Research by World Wildlife Fund, WWF, and the Imperial College found that a cut of 72% by 2030 was economically feasible. A group of climate and development charities wrote to the Prime Minister Boris Johnson recently calling for a 75% cut in emissions to show leadership at COP26. The signatories wrote, "Given the need for the UK to take on our fair share of global emissions reductions based on historic responsibility, we must move further and faster and commit to pursuing every opportunity to even exceed this target, as well as lead global efforts to close the gap to 1.5 degrees centigrade, the lower limit on global heating in the Paris Agreement." The government is likely to hail its new target as an improvement on current plans and a marked strengthening of the target that would have been expected if the UK was still part of the EU. Under the EU's plans, the UK's carbon cutting figure could have been as low as about 65%. The EU will continue to debate its NDC in near future, ahead of a climate ambition summit of world leaders to be hosted on December 12th by France and the UN to mark the 5th anniversary of the Paris Agreement. According to the Paris Agreement, all NDCs are supposed to be submitted by December 31st, but some countries are likely to miss the deadline. Media projected winner of 2020 U.S. presidential election Joe Biden has made clear his so-called commitment to rejoining the Paris Agreement when he takes office next January, and drawing up a new NDC will be one of his early tasks. Biden also purportedly supports setting the U.S. on a path to net zero emissions by 2050. China set a new target of net zero emissions by 2060, and with the EU, the UK, Japan, and many other developed countries now also aiming for net zero by 2050, the stage is set for a so-called global effort on a mid-century goal of a net zero economy. Climate Action Tracker calculated recently that these long-term commitments, if fulfilled, would lead to a rise in global temperatures of 2.1 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels, not far above the upper limit set in the Paris Agreement. However, the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres warned recently that while long-term targets were a major step forward, they needed to be backed up by shorter-term policies and actions. The NDC are seen as a vital stepping stone towards fulfilling the long-term targets on emissions, because carbon cutting needs to start now to prevent the further buildup of carbon in the atmosphere. Guterres delivered his starkest warning yet on the climate, saying humanity was at war with its own planet. He said, "Humanity is waging war on nature. This is suicidal. Nature always strikes back, and it is already doing so with growing force and fury. Biodiversity is collapsing. 1 million species are at risk of extinction. Ecosystems are disappearing before our eye," adding, "Human activities are at the root of our descent toward chaos, but that means human action can help to solve it."
It didn't take long before Mohammed bin Salman initiated a ruthless and relentless campaign to eliminate his rivals and critics, inside the royal court, inside the country, in the region, or beyond. The Khashoggi case that sparked international outrage was no aberration, but only the tip of the iceberg. Over the past few years, bin Salman's men have made attempts to pave his way to the throne by abducting, arresting, detaining, and even killing Saudi citizens who think the young prince is not the best choice as the next king. Bin Salman's main targets have turned out to be rights activists, political dissidents, prominent businessmen, and influential royals. Those languishing behind bars are the luckiest ones, in comparison to those already dead or still unaccounted for. The exact number of the victims is not clear, due to the secret nature of the elimination campaign, but a review of the known part of the story would illustrate the gravity of the situation. In the March palace purge, at least 20 princes were rounded up on bin Salman's orders. The most prominent ones still in detention are Prince Mohammed bin Saad bin Abdulaziz Al Saud, a member of the Baya, or Allegiance Council, which decides the succession of the Saudi throne. Prince Mohammed bin Nayef, the former crown prince and interior minister. And Prince Ahmed bin Abdulaziz, the son of Abdulaziz, Saudi Arabia's founder and first ruler. Ahmed had returned to the kingdom from London in late 2018 to block bin Salman's ascension to the throne, but ended up behind bars.
Well, I think he feels the need to make them afraid of himself, because he does feel those closest to him in power, because that is who could replace him. So you can see by his behavior that he is afraid, whether he ought to be or not, that's his perception. And so he's often pulling stunts to try and put those under him in line and to make sure that they fear him as a means of control.
The largest purge under bin Salman happened here at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in November 2017, where over 350 royals, officials, and businessmen were locked up. Prominent among them were Prince Mitab bin Abdullah, the son of the late King Abdullah. He was released later that month after reportedly paying more than $1 billion to the crown prince. And Prince Al-Walid bin Talal, one of the richest men on the planet. He was released in January 2018 after having reportedly reached a financial settlement with the royal court.
These are very powerful businessmen. These are fellow princes, and he essentially had them quarantined in a hotel. Nobody can do that other than a crown prince, and so he's flexing his power because he feels like he needs to, so that threats in the future will be given credibility. If he's willing to do something that seemingly seems this insane, the next time he makes a threat, everyone's going to listen, because he had no bounds and he got away with it. After pulling such a stunt, nothing happened. It was a little bit of bad PR, but what he feels he gained in fear outweighed any of the consequences, of which there were very little.
Putting the royals in jail or under house arrest was an unmistakable signal that no one was safe in the kingdom, including an untold number of former officials and business people like Khalid al-Tawajri, the former chief of the Saudi royal court, Amr al-Dabbah, the former Saudi Arabian General Investment Authority head, Mohammed Hussein Al-Amoudi, a Saudi-Ethiopian dual citizen and a major investor, and Dr. Walid Fatahi, a popular reformist.
This isn't the rulings of an honest monarch or of any republic or any sort of leadership. This is a totalitarian regime that uses insane punishments, death, assassinations, kidnapping, any means, as if the mafia or a criminal gang were in charge of the government, because he behaves in the same way as the lowest dregs of society that would be in jail were he not the crown prince.
Right now, there are many Saudi citizens, mainly former high-ranking officials, who have gone into exile to escape imprisonment and death. Saad al-Jabri, a former intelligence official and Prince Mohammed bin Nayef's right-hand man, is a case in point. Jabri fled Saudi Arabia to Canada in 2017 before being caught in the power struggle in the palace. His life has been under constant threat by bin Salman's hitmen. Almost 1 year before the murder of Khashoggi at the Saudi consulate in Istanbul in September 2017, in a separate purge that threw more than 60 people in jail, religious scholars like Sheikh Salman al-Oda, Awad al-Qarni, and Ali al-Omari were arrested. Saudi prosecutors have asked for death sentences for them as the sympathizers of the Muslim Brotherhood-inspired Shua movement. The arrest of more than a dozen women's rights activists, including Lujain al-Hathloul, Iman al-Nafjan, and Aziza al-Yusuf, is a well-known story. There are worrisome reports that these activists are under harrowing conditions, being subject to torture and sexual harassment.
This MBS is really dependent on what he feels is his tight supporters, these Takfiri Salafist Islamic groups who do not believe women should be driving or doing many other things. But really, MBS is not a fan of any kind of civil rights or human rights whatsoever. This is someone that will assassinate on a whim. He'll kidnap people, including a prime minister, and of course the starvation and utter destruction of the people of Yemen. There is not a sympathetic bone in his body, and he feels threatened by civil rights, because as more people drive, if the entire female population are allowed the same access to education and so forth, he feels that that is a threat to his position, and it undermines his extremist and fundamentalist religious views.
Besides the high-profile case of Jamal Khashoggi, who was killed in October 2018 in Istanbul by the Tiger Squad, a group of intelligence and military operatives established under Mohammed bin Salman, there are at least two other important cases. Prince Mansour bin Makrin, deputy governor of Asir province, was allegedly killed by the Tiger Squad in a helicopter crash in November 2017. Sources close to Mansour claim that he was attempting to flee the kingdom when he was killed. The other figure allegedly eliminated by the Tiger Squad is Sheikh Suleiman Abdulrahman Al-Thunyan, Mecca Public Court's president, who opposed bin Salman's 2030 economic vision. It is said he was killed in a hospital in Riyadh in October 2018 by an injection.
Well, he continues to have victims because, with the exception of Khashoggi, there's very little coverage and there aren't any consequences. So he continues this maniacal behavior. He once kidnapped the prime minister of Lebanon for days, and this got very little media attention. Can you imagine the global media if Iran had pulled such a stunt? Or even if the President of the United States had done such a thing, and yet somehow MBS gets a pass.
Almost all of the victims reviewed here belong to the political, social, and economic elite within the Saudi kingdom. The fate of dissidents outside the circle is a foregone conclusion. In all these cases, Saudi spin doctors have justified the Crown Prince's iron fist policy as a crackdown on corruption and as a fight for fundamental reforms. Is that so? Or as the proverb goes, the road to hell is paved with good intentions, at least in the case of the Saudi Crown Prince himself.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
on the news line.
Just a few months ago, the Israeli regime was celebrating the normalization of ties with several Arab nations, including the Persian Gulf states of the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain. But could this be the end of the extended arm of friendship, as hope of ties with the Saudi regime could be off before they're on, following the regional security conference in Bahrain? The possible change of plan comes following a speech at the conference by the former Saudi intelligence chief, Turki Al-Faisal, who has used the occasion to publicly make a stand against the Israeli regime, potentially reflecting the thoughts of many other senior Saudi royals in Riyadh. The former minister went on to state that the Israeli regime treatment of the people of Palestine was unacceptable, compared them to concentration camps, and noted that the Israeli regime did not discriminate when it came to the treatment of men, women and children, with whom it used brutal measures. However, the Israeli regime, although very red-faced at the accusations from a senior representative of a nation that they'd like to get closer to, were quick to return the remarks, with Israeli Foreign Minister Gabi Ashkenazi stating that the Saudi remarks did not reflect the spirit of the changing region. But it seems that the ties between the Saudi and Israeli regimes are not quite as they seem, with suggestions that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, having met the Saudi Crown Prince Bin Salman in a secret meeting, was nothing more than a lie, according to Al-Faisal, suggesting that not all is rosy between the two. So what sparked the remarks by Al-Faisal, and why did he choose the Bahrain summit to embarrass the Israeli regime? As we know, Tel Aviv is guilty of a whole host of sins against the Palestinians, as well as against other nations in the region. So is Turki Al-Faisal actually doing nothing more than speaking the truth when it comes to Israeli crimes?
It's very clear and true, and everybody, even those who support Israel, know it's true. The Gaza area is a huge concentration zone where Israel controls the calories that reach Palestinians, kills large numbers of them from time to time, and kills small numbers each day. So yes, a concentration zone, and it can't be seen as anything else. Palestinians are the most imprisoned people on earth, and Israel has a policy where their soldiers can kill Palestinians of any age, from 13 upwards, without fear of any consequences. So yes, it's a killing zone where Arabs can be killed by Jews without any comeback.
It seems that while still under the wing of the outgoing president of the United States of America, the Israeli regime appears to be content in the continuation of the status quo it finds itself in, namely, the blatant disregard for the people of Palestine and for international law. In spite of the United Nations passing Security Council Resolution 2334, stating that the destruction of Palestinian homes to make way for Israeli settlements on the West Bank was illegal, the regime still continues to destroy homes and lives, forcing the people of Palestine into tighter corners as the world simply stands by and watches. Murder and war crimes are also a regular pastime for the Israeli regime, with a recent killing of a Palestinian teenager being one of many examples, which also include Israeli soldiers being praised for killing unarmed Palestinian people, as well as the involvement of the Israeli regime in the assassinations of people abroad. Human Rights Watch, the charity observing events across the globe, have also condemned the Israeli regime for the arbitrary arrests of Palestinians, as well as making allegations of torture and mistreatment of Palestinian people by the regime a common factor in a way that the Israeli forces deal with people once in their custody, something that's once again a clear violation of international law. So maybe then Turki Al-Faisal had a clear and valid point when he said what he did. The evidence is clear for all to see, after all. Could this then raise a speculation as to the benefits of the regimes normalising ties with each other?
Saudi Arabia has famously tried to normalise ties with Israel for a very long time, before 2000, but I think it was 2001, the Arab Peace Initiative, formulated by Saudi Arabia, was rebuffed by Israel. And every approach by Saudi Arabia to normalise relations has been similarly rebuffed. So now it's quite clear the Israelis want normalisation, diplomatic recognition, and nothing in return, nothing for the Palestinians. And it's going to be very dangerous for any regime which recognises Israel, opens up the diplomatic relations, because there's a small thing like the news programs, and they will continue to show Arabs being killed by the Israeli military because they are Arabs. There will be permanent difficulty for the Saudi regime, once it normalizes, to justify that to its own population. That's, I think, what Turki al-Faisal is rightly afraid of.
There does, however, remain one very real possibility, namely that the allegations raised by al-Faisal are nothing more than a smokescreen to divert attention away from the secret relationship both Israel and Saudi crave, especially as a bond between the two would strengthen their mutual interest in resisting the Islamic Republic of Iran, and is something that the US would happily agree upon, adding their finger into the pie.
War, famine, and disease. These are just a few crises Yemen has been dealing with in over 5 years since the Saudi-led war broke out in the Arab country, aimed at bringing the government of former President Abdrabbuh Mansur Hadi back to power and crushing the popular Ansarullah movement. In the meantime, the United States is reportedly considering designating Ansarullah, which has been resisting the Saudi-led aggression, as a terrorist group. Oman's Foreign Minister Sayed Badr al-Busaidi said the Assistant U.S. Secretary of State mentioned the possibility during a visit to Muscat. The development came a day after the United Nations and international aid agencies warned Washington against the plan, citing concerns that the move would prevent life-saving aid from reaching the war-wracked country and would derail a related $700 million relief program.
Well, the major problem, of course, aside from the fact that the designation is completely, you know, uncalled for, it's unfair and unjust, for the basic reason that Ansarullah is not engaged in any terrorist attacks whatsoever and cannot in any way, shape, or form be considered a terrorist organization. They have never instigated an unprovoked attack against civilian targets in any country, neither in Yemen itself nor in nations abroad. And even the attacks on Saudi territory that they are being blamed for are legitimate military retaliations against a conflict that has been enforced upon them by Saudi Arabia.
David Beasley, executive director of the UN's World Food Program, told the Washington Post Daily newspaper earlier this week that the designation could hamper aid deliveries. Beasley's warning came following his meeting with U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, in which he expressed grave concerns about the blacklisting of Ansarullah. Last week, dozens of arms control and human rights organizations denounced a U.S. plan to sell multi-billion dollars worth of arms to the United Arab Emirates. In a letter to the U.S. Senate Department and Congress, 29 advocacy groups warned that arming the UAE would cause more humanitarian crises, as the country is a party to the conflicts in Yemen and Libya. The groups added that U.S. President Donald Trump's possible designation of Yemen's Ansarullah as a terrorist group can have catastrophic impacts on the world's largest humanitarian crisis and response, while also hampering UN-led efforts to secure a ceasefire and start peace talks. UN Special Envoy for Yemen, Martin Griffith, who has been mediating between the warring sides, called last month for all parties to the conflict to take final decisions required to implement a pact that aims to bring a nationwide ceasefire, specific measures to improve the lives of Yemenis, and the resumption of the political process to reach a lasting peace.
This is not necessarily an issue of who you support and who you oppose. This is not necessarily an issue of supporting Ansarullah, supporting the revolution of September 21 of 2014, did not necessarily support the National Salvation Government or to the organization that is called the Houthis, Ansarullah. You don't have to support them in order to agree that the United Nations peace negotiations are probably the only way to stop this conflict without either party having to be completely defeated in the field. If you want to stop the conflict and prevent further bloodshed and prevent the drawing out of this war for years to come, then you need to negotiate.
The ongoing conflict in Yemen shows no sign of abating, with more civilians being killed and displaced every day. In the meantime, The United States' moves on Yemen have not only damaged the horizons for peace, but also hamper efforts to provide much-needed aid to millions of people.
On Friday, the news agency Reuters published a report on a confidential letter sent by Iran to the International Atomic Energy Agency on Iran. The letter contained information on Iran's safeguard measures in its nuclear enrichment plant in the central city of Natanz. The leak prompted an angry reaction from Iran and other countries. Iran condemned the IAEA and criticized the leak. Iran's permanent envoy to the IAEA, Kazem Gharibabadi, said that the agency is responsible for the incident and that the agency's confidentiality mechanisms are seriously flawed. He said that Iran will shortly take legal action over the leak of information. Gharibabadi stressed that reporting confidential information without following the declassification procedure is illegal.
All safeguards and JCPOA reports, as well as Iran's correspondence with the IAEA and vice versa, are confidential. The IAEA shares its reports in its internal site, only accessible to its member states.
Gharibabadi said that Tehran has already asked the agency to minimize the amount of details it gives its member states in its reports and to avoid providing them with non-essential information. He said the history of Iran's legal protests against the IAEA over its failure to preserve confidential information dates back more than two decades.
In 2018, the Washington Post reported that Israeli intelligence agencies and experts have been have gotten a hold, actually, of sensitive information of Iran's nuclear capability through the IAEA. And this is no accident, given that the IAEA is heavily biased towards Israel. So it's natural that the spies involved have had institutional leverage as well with officials that were working with the IAEA and using it as an opportunity to extract information about Iran's nuclear capabilities.
Indeed, the incident is the latest in a series of tensions between Iran and the IAEA over the matter. This is not the first time that confidential information on Iran is leaked by the Atomic Agency. Over the years, and even before signing the 2015 nuclear deal known as the JCPOA, confidential information related to Iran has been leaked to non-parties to the JCPOA on many occasions. After signing the deal, Iran witnessed leakage of its confidential reports and information by the UN nuclear watchdog numerous times. With ongoing tension between Iran and the UN nuclear agency, it may be safe to say that the trust between Iran and the IAEA is at its lowest level. Observers say that the IAEA-Iran cooperation problems and lack of trust between them comes from a series of issues. The main reason can be that the UN nuclear watchdog's unprofessional behavior in conducting inspections in Iran. Tehran says on numerous occasions the agency's request was based on unfounded documents or baseless allegations. There were also incidents that fueled the distrust. One of the most significant cases was an IAEA inspector who tried to contaminate the Iranian nuclear facilities with nuclear materials of an unknown origin. Another case was the explosion that occurred at the Natanz nuclear facility. Iran says the only official party that has the details of the activities at Natanz was the IAEA. Observers say incidents like these are the source of distrust between Iran and the agency. No wonder Iran hesitates to allow certain inspections on its nuclear facilities. There are also serious allegations that indicate IAEA's mismanagement to protect Tehran's confidential information, which has led to the assassination of Iranian nuclear scientists over the years. U.S. political influence on the IAEA is another reason. The U.S. unilaterally withdrew from the deal in 2018 and imposed the toughest ever sanctions under its so-called maximum pressure campaign against Iran. Experts say now the U.S. is trying to turn the nuclear agency into part of their pressure campaign. They say the U.S. has always exploited international institutions to implement their policies against certain countries when they fail to directly pressure those countries.
There's no doubt about it. The IAEA is serving as a direct intelligence arm between Israel, the European Union, and the United States as an agency that has consistently demonstrated its bias and preferential treatment in favor of Israel, who have consistently used the agency to lobby for harsher aggression and action against Iran, in favor, obviously, of Israel, who at the same time is not a signatory on the Nuclear Proliferation Treaty, and has weapons stockpiles, nuclear stockpiles of its own that it does not allow any inspection of by international agencies.
Iran has always expressed readiness to further cooperate with the IAEA in a bid to reach an understanding on the unresolved issues. It also announced that it had full cooperation with the UN nuclear agency. However, the recent incidents shows that the IAEA once again has failed to build trust with Iran, which raises the question as to why Tehran should continue trusting the agency with its confidential information.
It seems that there's finally a light at the end of the tunnel when it comes to the development and administration of a vaccine against the COVID-19 virus, with multiple research centers finally in the latter stages of producing a viable and effective vaccine against the virus. However, while so close to the end, is the decision by the British to roll out the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine a little too soon. Already the British and the US have been arguing about the timing of the promise by the British government to start inoculating the most vulnerable groups of people in the UK by as early as this coming Monday, with the US criticising the British either due to the early release of a yet untested product, or maybe through jealousy of being pipped to the post by the Brits. With the UK having the worst rates in Europe, with already 60,000 people dead from the virus, the US is also in a difficult situation, with around 1,500 people dying each day, and already 276,000 people having succumbed to the coronavirus in America. Embarrassing figures for the outgoing president of the United States, who would have no doubt enjoyed being the first to distribute the vaccine. So why then are the British and Americans fighting over the issue? With the British choosing to start with the order of 40 million Pfizer-BioNTech vaccines, it seems odd that they have chosen a vaccine developed outside of the UK. Yet when one examines the effectiveness of the vaccines available, the British version, developed by Oxford University and AstraZeneca, is only around 62% effective. Hence maybe why the British have rushed ahead with the German-US version, quicker than the Americans and the Germans themselves. So could the tension then come from the attitude of the British when it comes to wanting to get the vaccine out as quickly as possible, rushing it through the regulators at such a pace? British Education Minister Gavin Williamson clearly flared tempers with his attitude towards the US and the EU when he stated that British regulators were obviously better, and then going one step further, saying the whole of the UK was better than the US and the EU. Clearly a diplomatic flop by publicly stating such words. What now remains to be seen is A, just how realistic the monumental task of distributing a vaccine that needs to be kept at minus 70 degrees will be, and B, will the US show any sympathy towards the UK should the process fail, and as Britain comes crashing out of the EU, looking at the US for a future trade deal. Britain is against the ropes when it comes to the Brexit negotiations with the EU. However, the announcement that the British will have the vaccine out on Monday is something that the British negotiating team will secretly be proud of as talks reach a stalemate in London. But the EU, with all its red tape, bureaucracy and processes, has yet to fully approve any developed vaccine so far and has taken the opportunity to criticise the UK for a hasty decision when it comes to announcing the vaccine will be available to various groups within Britain. Until the European Medicines Agency approves the vaccine, the rest of the continent will have to remain patient. However, there are arguments that the EMA is more rigorous than the British, leading the Germans to label the move by the British as problematic. But the UK may have one valid point when it comes to the rollout. If the vaccine is truly over 95% effective and it can save lives, then what's wrong with the British taking such a step? With the British finding themselves stuck in a desperate situation when it comes to agreeing a deal with the EU in the post-Brexit era, and time fast running out before the deadline approaches to switch to WTO rules, could then the decision by the British to start distribution be a final dig at the EU and prove that by no longer being part of the bloc, it can take such decisions without fallout that would have emerged from Brussels should they still have been members. But the truth of the matter is simple. This is one of the world's worst cases of a global pandemic, at least in modern times, and the economic impact, as well as the devastating cost of life, has left a scar and legacy that will never be forgotten. So whether it be Pfizer-BioNTech, AstraZeneca, Moderna, or Gamaleya, and whether it's the UK, the US, or the EU, or in fact any other country that starts the vaccine first, at the end of the day, this is a humanitarian issue, and when the time comes, the whole world will need the doses eventually.
The Last Savior.
Oh, the Savior of mankind, please show us a sign.
To the designer of the human civilization that is established on the unity of Almighty Allah. To the Redeemer of human volition and thought.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. Dear brothers and sisters, all around the world, assalamu alaikum, and welcome to yet another edition from series of The Last Savior from IRB English Radio. If you have been following this series of shows, we have been talking about the hadith and narrations around the topic of The Last Savior, and specifically the reason that the dreams can be looked at as a proof for the ordinary people about the authority of dreams, and if we are allowed to take the dreams as the proof for us to act upon them in our daily lives based on the beliefs that we have. And actually main topic is the authority of dream for some people to claim that they are Mahdi of the time, or the actually tell us some news about the arrival of the Imam of the Age, Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. Whether they can be trusted or not, we have said that these sort of dreams cannot be trusted, because the dreams need to be sadaqah, to be true dreams. And the real interpreters of the dreams are the infallible Imams, and it has some conditions for these dreams to be interpreted. Though some people among the believers, there are some people who can understand and actually interpret these dreams, but there are very few. Sheikh Murtada Karimi from Qom Seminary Schools. Sheikh Murtada, assalamu alaikum and welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam and thank you for having me.
Thanks for accepting the invitation. So Sheikh, please elaborate on this point, that what is it going to happen when we dream the Holy Prophet, and some come to us and tell us that they have dreamed the infallible Imam, but the information that is being transferred and is given to us is not something that can be issued by a prophet or imam. But how can we actually digest these things, Sheikh, and actually collect between these information?
I think this is the most important discussion in our series of discussions about the dreams. People claim that we have seen the infallibles, the prophet, the imams, and they have told us that, for example, you have to follow this claimant, which is, in our view, a false claimant. And according to some narration that you mentioned, Satan cannot be in the format of the prophet and the imam, and the imams even in the dreams, which inshallah we'll discuss about these narrations in details. So they come to this conclusion that, okay, in the dream I was told that this is the prophet talking to you, and he told me that you have to follow this claimant. This is not a new issue. This is the first point. I mean, it has been discussed by many scholars during the history of Islam and Shia school of thought. Sheikh Mufid, who passed away in 413, he has talked about the validity of the infallible prophet or imam's statement in the dreams. Sayyid al-Mutada, Allama Karajaki, Allama Hili, and so on and so forth. First of all, we can think of different ways. I mean, the types of the dreams that people see are very different. We have to, put them in different categories. Sometimes, because the point is that people come to us and claim that I have seen the prophet.
True.
Now, the question is that how you were made sure that this is the prophet talking to you. Us living in the time of the major occultician, we have not seen the prophet.
True.
And many of the narrations which talk about seeing the Prophet and the Imams in the dreams and the authority of such dreams, they exactly refer to the dream of the person who lived at the time of the Prophet or the Imams. And then he or she saw them in the dreams. So when a person comes to us and says that I saw the Prophet, the first question is that how are you sure that he was the Prophet?
Suppose that the Prophet himself in the dream told him that this is the Prophet you're
talking
about.
That's the point. Because of that, we have different categories.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, the first one is that sometimes a person has seen the Prophet or the Imam, like those people who lived at their time, and then he sees the same person in the dreams.
Mm-hmm.
This is the first one. Second of all, we are talking about the time of the major occultician. We have not seen any face of the infallibles in our time. In the dream, I just feel that this is the Prophet. It happens a lot to the people. I mean, even that person, he doesn't tell them that I'm the Prophet, I'm Imam Mahdi, I'm this infallible Imam. That person just feels that this is the Prophet or the Imam. The third one is that, as you mentioned, that very person in the dream, he tells this person that I am the Prophet or the Imam. In another case, the person just guesses that he was the Prophet or the Imam, or she was Lady Zahra Salamullahi Alayha, because of some evidences. For example, you know that in the books of supplication, we have some a'mal, some deeds to be done, some supplications to be said in order for people to see the infallibles. So a person has done some deeds and some supplications, and then he or she see a dream, and then they guess because of these evidences that this is the infallible Imam. So these are different categories, and we have to discuss in its own part. Now, for those people who lived at the time of the Imams and the Prophets, they can make sure that the person they saw was really the Prophet and the Imam. For them, there is no doubt.
True.
And many of the narrations which talk about seeing the Prophet and the Imams in the dreams and the authority of such dreams, they exactly refer to this type of dreams. The dream of the person who lived at the time of the Prophet or the Imams. And then he or she saw them in the dreams.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes we see in a dream a person that is similar to a painting that we saw from the Imam or the Prophet while we are awake. It happens a lot. That unfortunately, you see that nowadays some people claim that this image belongs to Prophet. There is a famous image which is attributed to Prophet Muhammad when he was youth. Or, for example, to Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam or Imam al-Mahdi and so on and so forth. Now, in the dream, I see the same image and painting. Is it a true dream? Of course not. I mean, none of these paintings are reliable. I mean, we cannot make sure that in reality this is the face of the Prophet. No one can prove that. So if in a dream I see a person which is exactly like that painting, I cannot claim that I have seen the Prophet. It is because it's been in my mind, in my brain, in my thoughts that this is the Prophet. I see the same image and painting. But can you make sure that this is the Prophet? Of course not. This will be more interesting when we pay attention to the fact that according to the narrations, of course, we are not talking about jurisprudence here. According to some narrations, the infallible themselves, they prohibited people from painting the face. So when they have prohibited the people, how then can we refer to the painting to prove that the person that I saw was the Prophet or the Imam? So if we see a person similar to a painting, we cannot claim that we have seen the Prophet. The other case is that sometimes some people, they see in the dream a person that they know in their life,
mm-hmm.
a righteous person. But in the dream, they are told that this is Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and his family, or Imam Mahdi, or Lady Zahra salamullahi alayha, but the face is similar to one of the people who lives at his time or her true time. Again, this dream is not a true dream, and they cannot claim that we have seen the infallible, because there is no narration which tell us that in the dream you can see the Prophet or the Imam or Lady Zahra salamullahi alayha in the face of another person. So those narrations which talk about seeing the Prophet and the Imams in the dreams, they are not talking about seeing them in the face of another person, which we know.
Wherever you be, I'll be with you, 'cause you're the one, my heart is to meet you.
So still we're talking about the invalidity or lack of authority of dreams for showing us the way, specifically in the leadership of the Islamic Ummah, right?
Yeah. The other category was that sometimes we feel that the person we saw in the dream was Imam Mahdi, was Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and his family. It happens a lot. In the dream, that person does not tell us that I am the Prophet or I am Imam Mahdi. We just feel that he is the Prophet or the Imam. Is it an authentic dream? No. You have to make sure that that person has been the Prophet or Imam Mahdi. Feeling here doesn't have any function. You have to be sure about that. Especially when, for example, we have done a kind of talqeen to ourselves. That, for example, this night I will saw the Prophet or the Imam because of the fact that I have done some recommended deeds and I have recited some supplications. According to the scholars, it is very likely that these dreams are related to our imaginations and thoughts before going to dreams. So I'm thinking about seeing the Prophet tonight. You know, for example, many people, it happens to them that before going to sleep, they think that I'm going to buy a car and a house and so on and so forth. And right the same night, they see in the dream that they have bought the car or the house that they were thinking about just before going to the dreams.
True.
So if before going to sleep, I think about that, about seeing the Prophet or Imam Mahdi in the dream or Lady Zahra salamullahi alayha, it is also likely that it happens to me.
Yeah.
But is it a reality? No. If you just feel that this person is the Prophet or the Imam, it doesn't prove that this is the reality.
Okay.
And now for the followers of this false claimant from Basra, this is very important. Why? Because this false claimant from Basra, Ahmad Ismail, he has a kind of instruction to his followers. For example, he says that you have to fast for 3 days and then do a kind of tawassul to Lady Zahra salamullahi alayha, or read a supplication for 40 days, then you will see a dream in which you will be told that I am with the truth. So it is very likely for these people also that they feel that that person in the dream has been the Prophet or Imam Mahdi, because they were thinking about that for 3 days, for 40 days, and then they dream and they just feel that this is the Prophet talking to them.
Very
or
true.
They just feel that this is Imam Mahdi alayhi salam talking to them. When it comes to the main category in which a person sees a dream, and in the dream the Prophet tells him that I am the Prophet, or the Imam Mahdi or another Imam tells him or her that I am the Imam or Lady Zahra salamullahi alayha, what about that? So it's different. It's different from feeling or guessing. In this case, they are telling us that they are the Prophet or the Imams.
So what is the difference then?
First of all, the first point is again regarding the interpretation of these dreams. The point is that even if we see the Prophet or the Imam, we mention that a lot, that even if you really see the Prophet or the Imam in your dream, How are you going to interpret that dream? We said that it happens a lot that you see something in the dream, but the interpretation is exactly otherwise. There is famous narration regarding this from Umm Ayman. We may see the prophet in the dream, but the interpretation is not as we think. It can be otherwise.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Murtada, and you respected listeners for your staying tuned. In this session, again, we have been talking about the validity and authority of dreams in showing us the way for the leadership of the Islamic Ummah specifically. We have talked about the true dreams and false dreams, but we said that even in case that there is a true dream, it needs to have a good interpretation, and the interpretation actually can be done through very few believers that they are not actually that easily accessible, and also the infallibles that we unfortunately are deprived of their presence. The case that we are specifically talking about is the validity and authority of true dreams to tell us who is going to be the imam of the Islamic society. Actually, we say that it can never ever work for these purposes. So the leadership of the Islamic Ummah is a very vital issue that needs strong proofs to prove the leader of the Islamic Ummah. So it cannot be let, it cannot be left to dreams and whether they're true or false dreams, and different issues around it, and also the person that we might dream, the person that we have already seen in our dreams, whether this is the infallible imam or not. These are the stories that actually was discussed a little bit, inshallah, will be talked about in depth in upcoming sessions. But let us again emphasize on this point, dear brothers and sisters, that the dreams can never be trusted in such way for appointment of the Islamic leader.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. O Allah, protect your representative, Al-Hujjah bin al-Hasan, Imam al-Mahdi, and send salutation upon him and his ancestors, now as well as all the times. Be his guardian, protector, guide, and assistance. Help him in his path and be watchful for him till you let him rule over the earth willingly and cause him to live in it for a long time.
IRIB English Radio.